As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Keith Law Show, episode 112. The computer tells me this is episode 112. I doubt that, but I never really learned to count past 99 anyway. I am going to be joined on this return program, first one since before the holidays. Happy New Year, everybody. By Seth Reese, who is one of the two writers of the screenplay for the movie The Menu, which right now is one of my top five movies from last year. We talk about the genesis of the idea for the movie, what it's saying about food, food culture, consumer culture, and then we sort of go off the rails in the best possible way, talking about Tar and other movies, and we may spoil a little bit of the ending of Tar, just a tiny bit. So if you haven't seen Tar and you actually want to see it, which is also a very good movie, tread carefully. Maybe save this episode for a little bit later. In the meantime, I have written just a couple of pieces for The Athletic because really right now I'm working on my off-season prospect rankings. I have started writing up the capsules for the top 100. That is currently scheduled to run January 30th, 2 weeks from today as I write this, which is terrifying. I think I say this every year and go through the same sort of emotional turmoil every year, and every year I somehow get it done. I guess one of these years I won't get it done, and then I will learn to maybe start earlier or complain less and write more, something like that. Although, of course, I'm turning 50 this year, so it's also possible that I'm just never going to learn anything ever again. I did write up a little bit. There have been some modest trades. I wrote up when the Dalton Varsho trade happened a couple of weeks ago. I wrote that up. You can find that piece on The Athletic. You can also find, I wrote a little bit about the Phillies-Tigers trade where Gregory Soto went from the Tigers to Philadelphia for a couple of players. Matt Vierling, who I like as a guy to take a step forward this year. So you can see those if you're a subscriber to The Athletic, and I hope you are. I have also continued my non-baseball writing. If you go over to Paste Magazine, you can see a couple of new game reviews from me. Riverside, which was a roll and write game that I really liked from last year, and Kites, which is a real-time cooperative game where you are flipping cards, playing cards to try to flip various sand timers in the middle and trying to get through the whole deck before the timers run out. It's a pretty simple premise, and I've played this with a lot of people now, and the consensus is that everyone really enjoys it. You can play the game in about 5, maybe 10 minutes at the most, which is probably its biggest selling point. And for those of you who enjoy my non-baseball, non-board game content, I've been doing mostly movie reviews over on my personal site, The Dish, meadowparty.com/blog. As my wife and I go through some of the likely Oscar candidates, likely nominees in various categories for this year. And finally, I do have a free email newsletter, tinyletter.com/KeithLaw. That is probably the best way to keep up with me as Twitter still standing, but you know, slowly crumbling. I'm still on Twitter, Instagram at Mr. MR Keith Law. At Facebook, Keith Law Writer. I'm even on Mastodon, keithlaw@mastodon.com. au. Who knows? If there's a new social media site, I'll sign up for it, even though personally, I assume none of them are going anywhere good. Now it is my pleasure to be joined by Seth Reese, who co-wrote the screenplay for the new-ish film, The Menu, which I absolutely loved, starring Ralph Fiennes. I hear different answers on how to pronounce his name. Fiennes. And Anya Taylor-Joy.
We can edit that out, and we won't tell him that you kind of botched his name.
Okay.
We won't tell him.
It's funny. I actually have a friend of a friend of the actor who swears it's Finn. And I was like, are we sure about that?
Bullshit. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
You are absolutely. Swear all you want.
Ralph Fiennes doesn't have friends of friends.
The Menu is streaming on HBO Max, and the Blu-ray and DVD arrives in stores on January 17th with never-before-seen bonus footage. So, Seth, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Keith.
So I'll start with the one hackneyed question, which I'm sure you guys get asked every time, but where did the idea for the film originate?
Well, it's great because my co-writer Will is probably so happy that he's not here for this because he's the one who always has to answer this question. Mm-hmm. And it got to a point where he was just like, I'm going to give the most slimmed down, edited version of this answer the next time I'm asked. But then when we were guests on Late Night with Seth Meyers, he's like, I guess I'll give the best version of the one of this answer. But no, he was Will was on his honeymoon in Norway, and he is very much like the Tyler character in the movie. So he, of the two of us, is the much bigger foodie, and he's the obsessive when it comes to food. Not so much now, but definitely back then. And so he went to a restaurant that he had to get on a boat, take it to an island, and he's kind of a claustrophobe. And he sort of said to his new wife, who is still his wife, congratulations to them. what if this went wrong? And we're sort of really entrusting the next 4.5 hours or so to these strangers. And Will, you know, he saw the boat leave while he was there. And then when he got back to New York and talked to me about it, Will and I have been working together for a long time. We both wrote The Onion together I was there for about 8 years, Will about the same. And so we kind of rose up at The Onion together, and we've always had a very similar sensibility. And he kind of told me this idea of like, people go to a high-end restaurant and the structure of it is the tasting menu. And I was like, great. And I immediately knew two things. One, I knew the tone that we were going to try to go at. I knew the targets we were going to try to go after. And I knew that it would be fun to write it with him. And that also we knew that just by virtue of the structure of the film, that if we ever sort of lost steam within a course, we move on to the next course.
Right.
Move on to the next course. And as a writer, I mean, you know, like you long for something that gives you structure in a piece, any kind of piece, right? So we knew we would start with the mousse bouche. We knew we'd end with dessert. So yes, we had a lot of work within that, but we knew, you know, as a writer, you have to escalate within those parameters.
It's funny you say that because I do a lot of lists and rankings, which is part of my day job, mm-hmm. Ranking prospects, ranking free agents, et cetera. And it is the ultimate savior when people, especially friends of mine who are not writers or who write, but something totally different. Like, how do you write so much? Like, well, I'm just like filling in. It's like connect the dots, right? Well, I know where to go next. I go to number 48.
And then the craft in that is how you probably know, well, it'll be cooler if this person was here, and then we'll build to this person. And, you know, like, and that there's crap to that too. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. So it's interesting you say that your partner was more of the foodie because, one of the many things, and I will praise this movie probably the entire time we're talking, but one thing I really appreciate was the way the script
That's
married.
Why I decided to do it.
Oh, great. Great. Yes. Excellent. You're just here for the fawning adulation.
Yes. Yep.
I appreciated the way that the script married there's respect for food and food culture, also with the satire of its worst elements, which to me is that's real satire, right? You go to the extreme of whatever you're satirizing, push just a little bit farther. So you stretch what's credible so the audience comes along with you for the entire ride. So I'm curious, it sounds like this was obviously part of the intent. And for you, as the less, you describe yourself as less of the foodie of the two, how did you relate to that portion of the, with that theme within the script?
Well, what I really related to, even though I've been to less of these places, I definitely related to chef as artist and the ego that goes into being an artist and how intense you have to live your art in order to feel like you're constantly at the top of your game. And actually, there are no artists that really have to do that as consistent as these chefs, because every day, same meals, menu changes, but you're getting a new wave influx of customers who are looking for the same quality that the last night's customers got. And you have to maintain this quality of excellence. And when you get your third Michelin star, you can't get a fourth. You can only maintain it. So the only thing you can do is lose it. And how crushing that would be. So I definitely related to that feeling and the fear of that feeling quite well with Will. And like you were saying, you know, I've been, Will and I were in Chicago. There was a point in time where Will and I wrote for The Onion in New York together, and we moved when the editorial offices moved from New York to Chicago. So I actually started to get more into fine dining when we were in Chicago. So I had been to Alinea. I'd been to another one restaurant that was really prominent for Will and I is a Michelin star restaurant called El Ideas in Chicago. The head chef there is Philip Foss. And he would come out and introduce every dish. Now the feeling of the restaurant is much more warm and cozier and
none of the heart.
Right. None of that. But, and it's definitely like a cooler vibe. And also chef, when people create their own dish, they're the ones who come out and present it. So it's a much more humane, much more humane version. I think that's where I was able to, as much as Will is obsessed with the food, I'm also super obsessed with ego and character. And so it was a very good mixture of those two things for us. And like you said, we simultaneously have so much respect for these places and the work that goes into them, but also it's 50% magic and 50% bullshit.
Yeah.
And you have to you have to also know that it's bullshit. And usually when people satirize something or parody something, for the most part, they usually start out kind of loving it. And that's why they know this topic so well. So,
you could see in the individual dishes, and I know you worked with Chef Dominique Crenn of Atelier Crenn in San Francisco, who's obviously extremely, extremely, extremely well-regarded, that she helped design some of the dishes, and they look like real dishes that you'd find in a restaurant. Like, they looked,
and they
sounded, right? They did, that was there. And in the things that the chef, Chef Julian Slowick's character says, too, he gives a lot of those talks about sustainability or respect for the ingredients, or this creature died so we could eat it, which to me is, made it essential for the satire to work, right? For that first portion of the film where something sinister is coming, I'm not going to spoil it, but you're waiting for that. Oh no, this is, I've been there. I've been to a restaurant just like, I've been to a couple just like that.
Yeah, and it's also the contradiction too of Slowick, because you know, he's saying that nature is timeless. Nature is the most precious thing, but also he's really contorting nature to his own end, because nature isn't exactly cooking things or popping things into a Paco jet. You know, that's not nature, you know? So, and like nature isn't how the island actually looks. He's contorted the island to look the way he wants to look it geometrically, the environment. So he's playing with nature. So I think and that was a really an amazing, brilliant idea from our production designer, Ethan Tobin. And Chef is contradicting himself a lot in the movie, because he keeps on saying, I'm doing something tonight that is egoless. Mm-hmm. But yet he also wants to create his masterpiece. And so it gets to a point where, like, thou doth protest too much, mm-hmm. about being egoless.
And I thought it was really brilliant to have, I'm forgetting the character's name, Janet McTeer is the actress. As
Lillian Bloom is her character, yeah.
Okay, thank you. And it's we find out over the course of the movie sort of her history with Chef Slowick, but she's clearly there. She's walking in with, she's kind of insufferable, obviously. Yes. And with this sort of attitude, like, this isn't going to be as good as the last time I was here. She's clearly ready to take him down a peg. And obviously she has her own ego too. The ego of the institution of the food critic, the ego of the food critic against the ego of the chef too. There's this little interplay. You could have made the whole movie out of that. It's a different film, obviously.
Oh, but yes.
I loved watching that little bit go back and forth.
And she loves to think that she made him. You know, without me and my writing, I wouldn't have been able to, or he would not have been able to get discovered again, come to this island, get the angel investor. And then you have her editor, who's just basically, you know, a sycophant, but without the infrastructure of the magazine, Lillian wouldn't be able to write and put it in the magazine. And so everyone is sort of providing infrastructure for this ego trip that they're all on, you know. The angel investor, he provides the entire infrastructure for the entire evening. And I think my mind wandered a touch there, but yes, the interplay between Lillian and Chef could have been its own movie. Yeah.
And the angel investor too, he's not a major part of the film, a secondary plot point there, but I mean, there's ego too, right? I bankrolled that's my restaurant, which does obviously become a bit of a part of the larger story here too. But of course there is. I was an investor. I own it. I found it. Or this guy doesn't happen without my money too.
Yeah, I'm allowed to ask for substitutions when I go to the restaurant and eat. And but what I think that speaks to is, no matter what, and I've actually had this conversation, because my day job is with late night. I'm a writer on Late Night with Seth Meyers, and I've talked about this with Seth. You're always looking for a check mark from somebody on top of you, no matter what. Someone is always on top. And you're always seeking that approval or that go ahead from somebody. Somebody always answers to somebody. And you could be the most powerful person. You might have the appearance of the most powerful person in the world. Chef seems so powerful, but he's at the mercy of this other guy who's also probably at the mercy of some other guy, you know? And so we wanted to, I think that's that, in that way, the movie definitely sort of maps its way onto other sort of institutions and corporate structures and all.
How did you end up working with Chef Kren? Had you approached, was it her specifically, or were you just looking for somebody who, I mean, obviously a very small number of chefs who really do this kind of food and do it credibly so that it could look, I mean, some of the dishes early in the film, you just look at, it's like, I'd eat that. Or I think so. Like I said, I recognized it.
So our producers and director reached out to Dominique. We reached out to a couple of chefs. Chef Kren was one of them. She read the script, loved it, got what it was doing. And then I think she's an artist. I mean, all these chefs are artists, but she also, I think she liked getting, because her food is much more warm. It's not as Chef Slowick's food is presented much colder. And I think, not in temperature, but obviously in style and aesthetic. And I think Chef Kren really liked getting into that character of, okay, what would his stuff look like? I know how I would do it. How would he do it? And I think she really, really enjoyed that purely as an artist. And when we were on set, and she was in Video Village for the first couple weeks of shooting, just to monitor stuff. And she would first one to point out, that's wrong, or they need to do that. I mean, she was so good. And also, one anecdote that I like really treasure from the whole process, because Will and I, we were on set for the entire shooting of the film, which if you're a movie writer, that's usually something that's not afforded to you. And I remember when we went, and it was like a couple days before Rafe was supposed to start shooting, and he wanted to present to me, Will, our director, Mark Mylod, our producer, Betsy Koch, what he had kind of been working on with Dominique Crenn, and also how he would present the first like four monologues that he was going to give. And we went to the restaurant, which hadn't been completely built yet. The set hadn't been completely built yet. And he just did every single one of them. He was off script. He had all his lines memorized. And it was just, that was the first time Will and I had heard the stuff that we wrote coming out of this man's mouth, who we basically wrote the script for. Will and I were just fucking blown away. It was crazy. It was truly like, oh my God, we got a movie.
Right.
Because it was incredible. Rafe has so many moves.
Yeah.
In his arsenal, that it's just, it calls for all of them in the script, and he knocked it out of the park. But he really worked with Dominique Crenn a lot about how a chef like that moves about the kitchen, because he's not cooking, he's observing.
Right.
He's
right.
The master of that domain, and he's looking and seeing, and with a light touch, no yelling. I mean, there's no yelling in the movie. He's not yelling at anybody. He's actually quite calm. And that is also a little bit more uneasy too.
Oh, absolutely. It is. Yeah. He's more intimidating because his demeanor is so, like, there's very little affect there. And you're like, is he mad? Is he mad at me? No, I'm watching the movie. He's not mad at me. Right. Was he the guy you envisioned for the chef? Cause it's just, God, it's him. I mean, that is.
Yeah, there was a moment where Will and I were writing. We were like, this is Rafe Fiennes. And then once we had that in our brain, we kind of started writing it toward him.
Sure.
Yeah.
It seemed like you took his character from Grand Budapest Hotel and his director from Hail Caesar a little bit and sort of smushed them in. There's more to it than that.
It's funny. That's totally valid. I always saw it, and Will always saw it. We never said anything to Rafe because we didn't want to. Never wanted to get into an actor's head, but we always said it's his character from Grand Budapest Hotel and his character from Schindler's List.
Yeah, that hits a little differently, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
One of the few things that all your diners at the restaurant, or most of them, I guess, have in common is there's also this desire to consume conspicuously, which I think is another one of the big, big thematic takeaways from the movie too, who's actually there for the food, for the actual eating of the food.
Right.
It is that they're eating at the Hawthorne to say they were there, to say they spent that money to impress somebody, or obviously Janet McTeer's in Lillian's case, maybe just to put it down. And it really gets under the chef's skin too. So was that, we were also just going for a commentary there on broader consumer culture beyond just the food culture.
I actually think that that's kind of the main thing that Will and I, one of the main things that Will and I wanted to get at. I mean, I think we kind of, not that there's anything wrong with this, but we kind of bristle a little bit at like eat the rich, because Will and I actually don't have a beef with rich people.
Right.
I think we have a beef with entitled people.
Yeah.
And so the movie, I think, really focuses on people who think they're entitled to content and consuming and consuming and consuming and consuming content without any real thought about who's producing the content for you, how hard it is to produce the content. But on the other side, because I think who you root for in the movie kind of changes a little bit throughout, this is also the job that the chef chose. It's his vocation.
Right.
So I guess, you either continue doing that, you continue doing that with a chip on your shoulder, or you lose your goddamn mind.
Right.
But so, because I think, there's a point where I think some people will see the chef as like this disseminator of justice against these rich people.
Yeah.
But, there's also a point where he's quoting Martin Luther King. So it's like, hey, buddy, take it easy.
Right.
And also these people, you need them, and you know you need them because you created this monster and you want to be known as the sort of high god of fine dining, and you need people who can afford it because your ingredients cost a lot of money. You all need each other, and so you all got to go, you know.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you're going to charge, it's like $1,200 a head. You mentioned it once in passing. Yeah. $1,250, there you go. So like, at that price point, this is what you get, right? You're going to get a lot of entitled, unpleasant people. And that's you just also, accept it.
That's right. And that's also, I don't think that restaurant's making a ton of money. That's what they need to continue open, keeping the lights on. It's not as if of that $1,250 a head, they get $700. You know, I feel like it's just barely getting by. This is all passion for all of them.
Mm-hmm. Your labor costs
for the chef, the staff. Yeah, this is their passion. You know. Yeah.
Yeah. The labor costs at that restaurant. This was one of the things. See, afterwards, obviously, you watch a movie like that and you start thinking through. Wait, how many people worked on that island? How many people live there? And you realize that is an it's like a small city that they're running there in terms of the staff.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Which is itself, again, just a great feat of imagination too, and that you kept building, but also what's the detail? You know, that we walk through where the staff sleep, right? Has to be, you can't just say, well, they all work on this private island, but they're just boating in every day. No. This is a compound. This is where everybody lives, which is also, I think, what's really good is one of the first moments in the movie where it's sort of like, something's not right here, which I love. You plant, there's a couple of little seeds and none of them is, it's not obvious. I really, when the first bad thing happens, to use the technical term,
right?
Both of us, okay, it's that, which was great because the whole time you're expecting something to go wrong. And then it's not what I expect. You said eat the rich. My one thing when I saw the trailer for this, because of course friends of mine, you know, I'm into food and into movies, are like, oh, this is for you. Obviously, I'm like, do they eat the people? Are they just eating people? Because I don't want to watch that. But it's not it.
I've in my time in this our earth of putting things out into the world that people can comment on and having a strict policy never, ever, ever to comment on anything that people are commenting on. That was like a strict policy at The Onion. Never comment on a commenter. Never. And I've never, it's better never do
it. You're better off.
There was a big part of me that desperately wanted to like write one thing that there is no cannibalism in this movie.
Yeah. Yes.
for everybody who thought that there would be. And for everybody who was like they were very clever. They were very like cute about, let me guess, cannibalism or cannibalism anyone or Soylent Green anyone. And it was just like, you know, and in fact, the first thing that, and this is not bullshit. This is totally true. The first thing that Will and I, when we sat down to write the movie, he said, there would be no cannibalism.
Yes.
Because Chef wants to make good food. And he wants that. And by the way, there was a point where several, I think like in an earlier script, people kind of got killed off along the way. And then we got to the point where like, no, he wants them all around for the entire meal. Because he wants all of them to experience the menu. The one person who doesn't get to experience the menu it's a punishment for him to not experience the menu. You know, he kind of, I mean, for people who haven't seen it yet, you know, he offs himself, but that's the biggest punishment of the night for him because he doesn't get to live until he has to die. And so, because he's the biggest psychotic, Tyler is the biggest psycho in the room.
As far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Absolutely. It becomes clear. Actually, I'll give credit to my wife. She called it. She just kept saying psycho, like the whole time.
Psycho.
Yes. Yeah. It's just, but again, you let it, I just love that you just a little bit, and you realize, oh my God, this guy is nuts.
Yeah. And you know, there's a moment and because when Will and I wrote the movie, writing this sort of like tone, this sort of hybrid of like horror, comedy, thriller really wasn't that hard for us as writers. Cause that's just like how we would execute this idea. It's very natural. I'd like to never think why it happens so easily. So it just happens. But to direct it and to put it up on its feet and to edit it so that all those three things are happening at once is quite difficult. And I think that sequence when like the big moment in the movie happens, and that's horrifying. And then you cut to Tyler and he's like, I didn't see that coming. And that's funny.
Yes.
I think people are like, what? Like, I think immediately in 10 seconds, that's the movie.
Oh, I see. Yes. Where you're getting all three of those elements in a very short. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because he's just like, what? Right. This is delicious. Can you believe this?
Yeah. Right.
I wanted to ask, do you, so it sounds like you don't mind when people characterize it as a horror movie. Cause I think it does. No. It misleads people a little bit in that this movie is not violent, like a modern horror. This isn't Halloween, whatever 17 that they're up to now.
Right.
There's more to it than that. I mean, it's horror maybe in the sense like Get Out was a horror movie. And then you look and when you Get Out, there's not actually any real violence until the very end of the movie, very close to the end of the movie. It's horror up here.
Horror up here. And I, you know, also like, Get Out's a true masterpiece. So I bristle more at putting it in the company of Get Out as opposed to just calling it a horror movie. But like, you know, there are elements of like a descent into madness is horrific. And you're watching a descent into madness. And the way Will and I write a descent into madness, it would be funny. We wouldn't write like the sad version of Descent into Madness. So it becomes a little bit more horror just based on the fact that we're not like, oh my God, this guy, you know? Cause like, you know, for example, another movie that's a masterpiece, but we'll just use it as a comparison. Like There Will Be Blood. It's also kind of horrific and like a descent into madness, but There Will Be Blood. You can watch it and be like, this is fucking funny. Like There Will Be Blood, it might be one of the darkest comedies ever made. Paul Thomas Anderson does a lot of that. He does like some of the most unsettling comedy you've ever seen. A lot of the time. Yeah.
I could see. Like, I'm glad you didn't do the sad descent into like nobody needs the movie version of The Sorrows of Young Werther or something. Like we've done
right.
Yes. Yeah. But I like. But to me, it is more. It's the unsettling vibe that sets in so early.
Exactly.
I'm good with that kind of horror. Like, you know, I think of when people ask me what kind of horror movie do you like, because I say I don't generally like horror movies. I don't watch the slasher films. To me, if the point is just to watch people suffer, I'm just out. It's just not for me. I always come back to The Others, which is a bloodless horror movie. But the whole time, I'm like, what's going to happen? Right? Which is great. I love that feeling. Yeah. And then afterwards, actually, generally after that feeling, I feel like I just, after that a movie like that, you know, I feel like I just ran 5 miles. I'm exhausted from that.
Yeah.
But it's great in the best possible way. And I think your movie does that, where at the end, it was, wow.
Yeah.
What just happened? Now let's spend the next 2 hours talking about it, which is
amazing. Which I think for Will and I, and also Mark and our producers, I think that's been kind of admittedly a delight that people have decided that they want to talk about it afterwards. Nothing really beats that. As someone who loves movies and you love movies and Will loves movies, I won't say the best ones. I'll just, the ones that are sort of have some sort of impact on your life are ones that you really think about them afterwards, and then you can't wait to talk to your friends with them afterwards. And to have a movie that kind of does that, I have been, as much as I'm anti commenting on the commenters, I really appreciate, and I know Will really appreciates the fact that that is kind of existing, and we're definitely humbled by that, and we think it's really goddamn cool.
When my wife and I finish a movie, even movies we don't love, we generally are both on our phones then, like, looking at other we try not to read too much beforehand, right. But we're looking at reviews, or if it's just based in history, mm-hmm. What's the actual story? And I'd say The Menu and Tar are the two that we spent the most time reading
again.
Right? Yeah, right. Tar's again. Pretty damn good.
I love that you love The Menu. I saw Tar twice in the theaters.
Did you?
Yeah. I think Tar is a true masterpiece.
Oh, it's
Did you read the New Yorker article on him recently?
Yes. Incredible. Just the other day, right?
The anecdote, first off, it's incredible. He's incredible. His gap in work is incredible.
Right.
Just the fact that that happened.
Yeah.
The Tom Cruise anecdote is the best.
Is amazing. Amazing. That whole piece was great.
Yeah. There's so much patience that has to go into making movies that I don't have. And this is my first one. And I'm sure, I hope to God there's a second one, but like that whole Tom Cruise anecdote with him and the amount of patience that would take and nerves that would fray in order. And I don't, your listeners, there's just an anecdote in this Todd Field New Yorker piece where basically Tom Cruise instructs Todd Field on how to make sure In the Bedroom ends up being released into the public the way it premiered at Sundance, and how to play Harvey Weinstein, how to play him to make sure that he didn't cut it to shreds. And Tom Cruise gives the playbook on how to do it. And it take to follow that playbook to a T and for it to work is not only shows a lot of patience across the board. But that's such a great, that was such a great anecdote. Really, yeah.
It's funny you mentioned that the patience required to make a movie, and I've never written a movie or any screenplay, but I have written two books. And the craziest thing I ever did in my life was write the second one, because I knew what it took. The first one, you're like, I can write a book. Come on. I write the equivalent of a book every 6 months for work, right? That's not a big deal.
Now, I have a question for you from somebody who hasn't written books. Are there horror stories in terms of, I think there are legendary horror stories of like, this book took me, after I finished it, took me 10 years to get to a publisher and to get published. And because of this roadblock and this roadblock and this roadblock, I assume there are well-documented horror stories with that as well.
Yeah. The one I hear the most, and I was lucky this was not true for me, because I had the established writing
career. Me too.
Career.
Me will too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. But that you hear the stories, obviously J.K. Rowling's the famous one. How many times did she submit to people? But you hear a ton of those where people they went through every publishing house more than once and couldn't get a bite, or, you know, their first couple of attempts didn't get a bite. And then it's only after they finally get one published, they have a success, and the publisher's like, you got anything else in the desk maybe that we can have? I would hear those before I started, when I first went to my, the agent who does my contracts, did my contracts with the ESPN, now with The Athletic. He said, I want to write a book. And she's like, great. Let me pass you to somebody who does that stuff. And my expectation was that they would be like, you're an idiot. You can't write a book. People don't write. No. Right. Who are you to write a book? When I've actually got a deal to write a book based on, I had to write a
book. And then you in the back of your mind were like, I know a lot of idiots and they write books.
That's also true. I've met a few of them. Some might listen to this podcast, so maybe I should.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
Yeah,
oh, believe
probably.
Me, they do.
Yes.
And they know that you've talked about them.
Yeah, that's so true.
the thing about that what Will and I were always very lucky. Our producers, Adam McKay and Betsy Koch, mm-hmm. always said this movie is getting made. No matter what, at every juncture, whether a director came on and then left the project, or we had another talk with another director and that didn't work out, they always said, don't worry, it's going to get made. It's a good script. It'll get made. And to hear that over and over from people who are making things, especially McKay, who's made things, directed things, is worth its psychological weight in gold, especially if you haven't gone through the process before. And you're aware of all the horror stories of Hollywood, of things in development, of all that stuff. It's like Die Hard. Frank Sinatra had to pass on the script for Die Hard because he actually starred in the novel's first screenplay based on that character. And so he had the rights to the John McClane character, and he had to pass, and you know, and he did, and like, mm-hmm. But it would took years for that movie to get made, all that kind of stuff. It's insane. It's fun. The lure of Hollywood is fun, but it's like, I don't want to be part of it.
No, the Todd Field story you mentioned, I forgot what it was he was trying to adapt. It was a couple of things. He tried to adapt some apparently unadaptable work, things that people think will never be adapted. But there was one in particular, he got stuck. It was close to 10 years working on a particular project that just didn't happen. Yeah. And that I have a very hard time with that. And I've been lucky, right? When I write for my day job, I write and they put it into WordPress, and before I know it, it's live.
Yeah, that's the luck that I've had being at Late Night and also at The Onion before that. It's just like we had this thing that did have some semblance of structure that you kind of knew where things stood.
Yes.
And you know, as opposed to waiting for that check mark, you know?
Right. Knowing something's going to see the light of day is a huge, for me at least, it would be very hard for me knowing, could I read a lot of fiction? Would I love to write a novel? Sure. I could write one and it would never go anywhere beyond the room I'm sitting in right now. And that's pretty intimidating to me.
That's true. But then again, if you have this idea that's really coming out of you that you have to work on, I bet you just will bite the bullet and do it.
Yeah, maybe I will.
Because you have enough hubris and ego to think, I'll see the light of the day.
Yeah, well.
Just at the end.
I don't lack for those. According to people around me, yes, I am full up on those things.
Yeah.
So just before I let you go, I did want to ask though, do you, feel free to spoil at least a little bit, but the end of Tar, which has been since we're, and I won't spoil the end of The Menu, obviously, but there's a lot of think pieces.
Let's spoil Tar. We're not going to
Let's spoil Tar, exactly. Tar's longer movie anyway. My daughter asked, would I like Tar? And I'm like, no, you'd hate that movie.
She might, though. She should watch it. Just make sure she watches it.
At some point, she's 16 with the attention span of a peanut, and I love my daughter, but there's just like, that's just not happening. She's being like, this is a lot of talking.
She might like it because you're saying she won't. So just out of pure
fair.
Spite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, she totally would spite watch something. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But where do you come down on the ending of Tar being
real?
Not real? It is brilliant. It is. The whole movie is brilliant.
It's real.
The way they talk,
I don't think
is
it's in anyone's mind. Okay. I've heard that. I don't think that last act is in her mind. I think it's totally what's happening. And I had the thought that, you know, if Tar were 2.5 more hours long,
mm-hmm.
and we watched her sort of her slow but sure comeback to the mainstream, it would be just as sad and just as horrifying. And by the time that last shot of her maybe conducting in Berlin happened again, or New York or wherever, I'm sure we wouldn't be like, she did it. We'd be like, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Cause that's why that movie's so fucking brilliant. I'm jealous.
Amazing.
I'm jealous of it.
It is just the dialogue alone. The people in movies, television don't talk like that. And yet it never once rang false to me. It's just an elevated vocabulary style of speaking. And you should think she's just impossibly pretentious. And so are other people talking to her.
Do you know Adam Gopnik personally?
No, I don't. I just read quite a bit
of
his work.
Isn't it kind of unfair that he was pretty good?
Oh, yes. I had that thought. It was like, no, that's not somebody playing Adam Gopnik. That's actually Adam Gopnik. That's the dream, right? Yeah.
He was good in the movie. That's so weird.
Completely credible. 100%. You're like, no, I'm watching an actual, it really reads, you know what I mean? Like you're watching an actual live Q&A.
Yeah.
With a real person.
Like New Yorker Theater, New Yorker Festival. all there. It was really good. Yeah.
That sold me so he made so many daring choices at the beginning, including like putting the credits at the beginning of other stuff. Yeah. That starting with that Q&A, and I was like, "Oh my God, I'm so into this. Why am I so into this? This is ridiculous, but I'm sold."
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was great. That was it's a good movie year, not least because your movie, The Menu, is part of it.
Thank you very much.
My guest today is Seth Reese. Thank you so much for joining me. The Menu is available to stream on HBO Max. It is out on DVD and Blu-ray on January 17th with multiple deleted scenes, one of which I at least saw out on the interwebs too, and it was with Lillian Bloom's character too. Yes. And I actually liked it quite a bit. I was like, oh, this is good. I like this.
Did you think it helps me
think
movie?
About it more. I don't know. You know, those are. I don't know, right? I always wonder, like, it's easy to say, yeah, of course it would. But if it had been in the movie, would I have been like, eh, we don't need it. But after the fact, as part of my thinking through everything I saw, I was like, oh, that's good background. I like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's on background. It's a web extra.
Yeah, it was great. It worked perfectly. Excellent. Seth, thank you again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. Again, the Top 100 Prospects package will begin running as of right now, scheduled for January 30th. That week, you will also see the ranking of the farm systems and then the team-by-team reports going 20 prospects deep in every team's farm system are currently scheduled to run the following week. So that would be, what, February 6th? I don't have a calendar in front of me, but I can sort of do math as long as it doesn't involve too many digits. So it would be February 6th, and we'd run one division a day for that week leading up to the Super Bowl, which I'm assuming at this point the Eagles are going to be in and to win, because it's going to be very difficult around here if they don't, given the way that they started the season. Thank you all so much for listening. Stay safe.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.